This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Colonel Herbert Chandler. Today's date is the 29th of September, 2004. I, again, am in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech, and I'm speaking with the colonel by telephone, and you're in Virginia. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Yesterday, we wound up with your work down at Fort Bragg. That important interval in 1960, I think.
Right.
And you mentioned that you had helped to draft the new curriculum.
Right, for the counterinsurgency.
On counterinsurgency, yeah. How did it come to you to do that job?
Well, because I was told to take that course by my unit in Bad Souls.
Mm-hmm.
And I finished the special warfare course. And the counterinsurgency course didn't start for 6 weeks, and so I was assigned to the TDY, to the counterinsurgency school, to take that course, and I had to help develop it.
Now, what did you? Who were you working with to help develop it? Do you remember?
Oh well, there were a whole bunch of people. I don't remember.
Okay.
I just developed two or three of the lessons.
And. What were they on, or what materials did you use? Do you remember any of that?
Oh, no. I think I talked about Army aircraft and what aircraft they were. I used that period also to get back into the airborne business. I make as many parachute jumps as I could. They had a lot of parachute jumps going on.
Mm-hmm.
But it had been 9 years between my parachute school, between my fifth and my sixth parachute jump, so I was going out and making as many jumps as I could.
How many did you make? Do you remember?
No. I made about six or seven. I'm sure I made night jumps and all that.
The
jumps were different because when I went through parachute school in 1962, they used a C-46,
uh-huh.
And now they're using C-130, and there were many, many other people involved, many other troopers, and so I just went out and did as many as they had scheduled.
That makes me wonder too. Who was in charge of the school itself?
Oh boy, I don't know.
There
was a colonel who was in charge of it, I think.
Okay. If I said a name to you, maybe I don't know if this rings a bell at all. Was William Yarborough in charge?
He might have been there.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he was the head of the whole. The whole Special Warfare Center.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was some colonel who was in charge of the course.
Can you describe as much as you might remember about the new CI counterinsurgency course itself? To what degree, for example, did it focus on Southeast Asia, or was it a more general course?
It was more general.
Mm-hmm.
We had people in the course from Germany and from Italy, and I made friends with a couple of Italians and a German officer who was the going to go back to Germany, and that's where I was heading. So I made friends with them. It was more general. We talked about the ink spot, where you develop a base, basically, and then spread out from there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about all I remember about that.
Okay. So you helped design a couple of modules, if you will,
yeah,
for the course, and then you actually also participated in taking the course.
In taking the course, except for the lessons that I gave.
That you had to teach, right?
Yeah.
And you were also doing your jumps. What else was going on at Fort Bragg at that time? Anything else for you?
No, not that I know of. I wasn't involved in anything there.
Okay.
But I was just TUI from Batholz, really.
Where did you go when you left Fort Bragg?
Well, I had leave, and then I went to Fort Dix, the people that sent us to Germany, the military transport system. I remember very well. My orders were to report to there on the 21st of November.
Mm-hmm.
And my very best friend, who was a advertising man in New York, my friend from high school,
mm-hmm,
was going to get married on the 21st of November, and he asked me to be his best man. So I called up and told them that I'd be there on the 22nd of November. And they said, no, your order said 21st of November. I said, well, I'm going to be busy on the 21st and can't make it. So you can either you know, do what you want to for one day. Call me AWOL, or I won't be there on the 22nd. And so as a reward for this, they, instead of flying me over, they put me on a ship going over.
Oh, jeez. How long did it take?
Oh, God. We couldn't, the weather was so bad in November that we couldn't go straight into Bremerhaven. We had to go, we couldn't go to the north of England. We had to go to the south of England and up the English Channel. So it took a long time. And I was given the detail of waking up the people who were supposed to be on KP and who had details and so on. And fortunately, I had two warrant officers assigned to me to help me do that, and they took care of everything. I really love warrant officers. These guys were wonderful. They'd get the people out and get the details organized. I didn't really have to do anything on the ship, so it was a very rough journey.
But that was a relief to have them with you.
Oh, God, yes. They did everything. I love warrant officers. They're all experienced. Wonderful people.
Do you remember either of their names?
No, I sure don't.
Did you ever come across them again?
Never again. No.
Oh, that's funny.
But they really helped me on that ship.
Well, tell me about your new assignment.
Well, I'll tell you, when I first, I met one man on that ship who was going to Bad Tolls with me. And I had arranged to pick up a car in Wolfsburg in northern Germany. I was going to pick up a Volkswagen. And so he and I traveled together. We went to Wolfsburg and picked up my my Volkswagen and then began driving down to Bad Tolls. And I remember we didn't have any German money, and so we had to stop someplace and get some German money. And then we took about 2-3 days to get down to Bad Tolls, which is south of Munich.
Now, what was the unit that you were assigned to?
10th Special Forces Group.
Okay. And what was their overall mission?
Well, the Special Forces was organized basically to parachute into Eastern Europe and organize the partisans in case the Russians attacked. We were a Polish team, basically, when I got there, and they were studying Polish, and we were supposed to go into Poland when the war started and organize the partisans.
Now, did you have language training as well?
A little bit. We were beginning to get it down there, a little bit of Polish training. We had a couple of Polish enlisted men in the unit. Our radio man was a Sergeant Kleziak, who had come from Poland, was a Polish refugee. They had what they called a lot of Lajaks people there. And I think the Lajaks, I never found out what it was, but I think it was something that allowed them to enlist former Eastern Europeans into the U.S. Army, and they put them all in Bad Tolls. So they would go back to where they came from. But then we had a demonstration. President Kennedy came over, and we had a demonstration in Berlin for him. One of my sergeants, I remember Sergeant Lisi, was a bow and arrow expert. He gave a demonstration of that, and we got some other demonstrations. And President Kennedy, who had authorized our Green Berets while I was at Fort Bragg, said it was a shame to waste these people waiting for the war to begin. Why didn't they do valuable counterinsurgency work in the Middle East while before the war started? And everybody thought that was a good idea, and so my team turned from a Polish team to an Iranian team, and we started studying Farsi.
No kidding.
And I had one man in my team, Coy Melton, Sergeant Coy Melton, who had been at the Army Language School for 18 months studying Farsi. And then I sent my team sergeant, Sergeant Lisi, up to Munich, and he took a 100-hour course in Farsi. And then between the two of them, they taught us Farsi 4 hours a day.
And this included you. You were sitting in, too.
Oh, sure.
How big was the team?
A 12-man team. like all special force teams.
Mm-hmm. And it was just your team that was reoriented?
Well, the Farsi team. No, all the others were reoriented. They spoke Arabic and, and Turkish. And
how many teams altogether, Colonel? Do you remember?
Oh, I don't remember.
But a handful, or?
Well, a company full.
Okay. And did you attend the demonstrations for Kennedy that day?
No, I didn't. I had seen the same demonstration when he, or similar demonstration when he came down to Fort Bragg, or was it Fort Bragg or Fort Benning? Fort Bragg.
Uh-huh.
It was Fort Bragg, and he came down and we came to the same demonstrations down there, similar demonstrations.
Uh-huh.
And so he was very familiar with the Gray Eagle concept. Oh, I tell you one thing that happened at Fort Bragg.
Uh-huh.
This was my doing, too. They were talking about starting a Special Forces Museum.
Yes, uh-huh.
And so I told them, before they started the Special Forces Museum, they ought to go up to West Point and talk to the people up there who had a big and beautiful museum, how to get started and so on. And so they arranged a plane to go up, and I arranged to have that plane go up on Friday or Thursday so we could see the football game at West Point.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Special Warfare School, there were a lot of students, second lieutenants, who had been my students to West Point. So I loaded up the airplane with those students. And we flew up to West Point to talk about setting up a museum and also to see the football game.
You worked the football game in there, though.
Oh, yeah, that had to be. What I do remember was that on Monday, we were authorized to wear green berets.
Okay.
And so all these second lieutenants wore their green berets on Saturdays to the football game.
And that would have been the first time, I'm sure.
First time. Well, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was watching the football game, too. And he caught these guys, and he didn't approve of the green berets, so he had a bunch of them standing tall in front of him, one asking why they wore their green berets a day early. And he asked this one guy, one second lieutenant, what his name was. And he said, Ben Spivey the third, sir. And Ben Spivey the second was the J3 who was standing right behind the chairman, his father.
Now, was the chairman at that time, was that Lemnitzer, or?
Oh, gee, I don't know.
Don't remember?
No.
Oh, okay.
I think it was not Lemnitzer.
Earlier than that?
I don't know. It's later than that.
Oh, I'm
it was
sorry.
The 60s.
Huh. You mentioned was the Gray Eagle concept?
No, I thought that up later on.
Oh, okay. Now, can you tell me what that is, just since you mentioned it here?
Oh, the Gray Eagles organized that. That didn't go very far because the military didn't endorse it, but
mm-hmm.
that was the use of retired people to carry out military training missions overseas.
Mm-hmm.
It was modeled after the International Executive Service Corps, which takes corporate officials, retired corporate officials, serving
right.
overseas.
Right. That when did that concept sort of arise?
Oh, that was after I retired.
Oh, that was sometime later.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Had you seen the president when he came down to Fort Bragg?
Yeah, I had seen the demonstration they put on there.
Okay. Were you actually around the president at all?
No, no.
Okay. I just wondered if you formed any impression of him.
Oh, no.
Not really.
He liked the Green Berets.
Yes, sir.
He authorized our Green Berets.
Yes, sir. And as you noted, he was very interested in counterinsurgency
yeah,
concepts.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Now,
I'll tell you another
yes, please.
Funny story.
Yes, please.
When I was taking the counterinsurgency course,
mm-hmm.
there was a captain from Taiwan sitting next to me, and next to him was a colonel from Taiwan. And it turned out, the reason the captain from Taiwan was there was to make sure that the colonel from Taiwan got good grades.
Help him along?
And pass the course,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And consequently, they found sometime in the early part of the course that the captain from Taiwan had TB. So they got him out of there to the hospital, I guess.
Oh, sure.
And it turned out that the colonel from Taiwan then moved one seat over. It became my responsibility to see that he got a good grade in the course.
How would he have done without your help?
I don't know.
Not so good, maybe?
Not so good. Some of the language skills of some of the people weren't very good.
Okay, Did you ever come across him again?
No.
Okay. But you helped him out?
Oh, yeah. Helped him pass the course. He copied from my paper.
Do you think he got anything out of it?
Oh, yeah, I got something out of it.
Probably a promotion, I'm guessing.
Yeah,
but...
I guess so.
How long did you stay with the... Back in Germany, how long did you stay with the 12-man team that was working on Iranian issues?
Well, we went to Iran.
Okay, when was that?
Let me see. It must have been 61.
Mm-hmm.
In April of 60, June probably of 61, an American airplane had crashed in December. A mapping plane had crashed in December. They had five people aboard.
Mm-hmm.
And they were under visual flight rules, and they couldn't see anything. And so they figured they would let themselves down through the clouds and see if they could find the base at Isfahan.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And they were flying about 15,000 feet, a little lower than them. And the mountain was the Zardekur, and it was 14,921 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And the plane sort of hit the snow and flipped over.
And
these guys, three of them, said, "We'll go get help," and they got in their sleeping bags and started rolling down the hill. And the snow was about 18 feet deep then, and I don't know where they were going, because it was a two-day journey to any place, and probably more in the snow. The next day, the rescuers came and got two of them who had not gotten too far from the plane, and three guys were missing, and they were declared dead. And the wives said, no, they're not dead. You got to go find them. Some passing tribesmen might have found them. So there were three guys missing, and it was decided that my team, reinforced with six mountain climbers, would go down and speak Farsi and go into the area and good familiarization and find three bodies up at the Zardekur.
Mm-hmm.
So we went, and there was a six-man, sub-man, really. My executive officer was one of them who climbed the mountain. We all climbed the mountain to set up base camp there. And they searched for a week or so and found three bodies, and we got out of there. And in the meantime, we set up a hospital down at the base camp in a little village called Kurang, which was off the beaten path.
I'll bet.
And we set up a hospital for the people there. Many of them were sheep herders. Many of them were farmers. Some of them were kids who were home for Christmas, home for their vacation, whatever it was. They were all Muslims, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But we treated a lot of people there. My medics were kept very busy. And Coy Melton, who spoke good Farsi, was very helpful. You know, when you say, take two of those and see me in the morning.
Yes.
In Farsi, they really impressed the people. And we gave some classes to most of them on common preventive medicine, like keep the animals in the same house that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Get the water upstream and pee downstream, things like that.
Sure.
they weren't doing. I remember every time we went in to rent some mules to go to the high camp, the guy would go outside and just reach in the sewer there. There were two little streets, and he would boil the water and make tea, and we'd have tea, but we made sure he boiled it for a long, long time.
Yes, sir. And you were there for about a week or so?
Well, about 2 weeks.
Okay.
Then we got into Tehran, and we went to our base camp. We were in Batol. Our C-130s were in Evreux, France.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to Evreux, France, somehow or other. I don't remember how we got there. Probably we flew up to Evreux, France, and got a C-130 that was dedicated to us to take us down to Tehran.
So the whole team would have parachuted in, is that...
No. We didn't parachute in at all. We went to Tehran, and they gave us a couple of trucks and an ambulance, and we took that down to Kurang. We spent the night in Isfahan at the American mission there. It was very nice. They had a movie, and very nice. We stayed at some hotel in Isfahan. And then the next day from Isfahan, we drove to, where was it? Not Jafabad. That's where the road to Kurang started, which was a little dirt road.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove into Kurang instead of base camp outside of the village.
Let me ask, did any Iranian officials or experts accompany the team? How many?
Two of them. We had two Iranians and one American from the MAG. Dr. Barquist was a doctor from the MAG, and they sent him to keep an eye on us. And Mr. Ghilampour was on the Olympic Committee of Iran, I think. And there was a Sergeant Faraji who was in their special forces. They were trying to turn into a special force. He was in their parachute unit.
Uh-huh.
So Faraji and Ghilampour came along to be our guide and sort of just to keep tabs on us.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask what the location was, the distance from the plane to where you actually found the men?
Oh, God. Well, we were down in Kurang, and it took most of the day to climb the mountains. The mountains were sort of covered with scree, with rocks, and until we got to the snow, we could take the mules. They ate, they grazed as we went along. They ate this this kind of, it was a very prickly plant. I don't know what it was. It looked like holly, but it wasn't holly. And the mules ate that.
Mm-hmm.
And took the mules until we came to the snow, and there was no grazing about that. So then all the rest of the men carried what the mules were carrying up to where the base camp was, which was near the crash site, and we dropped it there and they came on back. So the six men that stayed at the high camp had all these supplies.
Right. Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, though, the snow was covered with locusts. Locusts coming from the west, I think, were getting up to 14,000 feet and dying. And so the snow was covered with a couple of inches of dead locusts.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah.
What a strange thing that must have been.
Oh, yeah. Well, I went up to the high camp one time, and, you know, you wake up in the morning, and you get your little stove going,
right,
and you boil some water, and you put some coffee in the water, and you mix a cup of coffee, and you're out ready to drink it, and flop, a big locust drops into it. And so you throw it out and start again.
Right. You had to adapt. Easily.
And those people who lived up there, I just went up for one day.
That's right.
People who lived up there had to adapt.
Wow.
They blew the plane up and they found three bodies who were covered in the snow.
Uh-huh.
One of them was pretty exposed and he had been burned by the sun. And one of them they found when the snow melted, his knee was sort of sticking up and they dug him out.
Uh-huh.
And then the third one they found by probing through the snow.
Was this a military flight?
Oh, yeah, sure, an Otter.
Mm-hmm.
Five people aboard.
Well,
co-pilot, crew chief, and two passengers. One of the passengers was the chief of the Amish MAG. They called the Gendarmerie.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know which of them were dead and which were alive and which were rescued. But three of them were dead.
Yeah. And you transported, or your team transported the bodies out of there?
We transported the bodies to Tehran, where they had a graves registration group from Turkey, I think, came in and took care of them.
Okay.
So then we got out of there. And it's really funny. They told us, and we were coming back to Batos, And they told us they were having an IG inspection that weekend and not to come back until Monday.
Uh-huh.
And we have C-130 there, so we could either come back through Athens or we could come back through Vienna. And I can let the team choose whether they want to go to Austria, to Greece or to Vienna.
What'd they choose?
Oh, most of them chose Vienna. I chose Athens because they'd been there before on the way down.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was the only one that went through Vienna because I'd never been there before.
And we
all met in Munich on Monday morning, Monday afternoon.
Now, when you got back to Germany, then did you continue to train and prepare for that kind of operation still?
That's right. We continued to train for RC.
Uh-huh.
I think after I left, they had two more missions to Iran to train the airborne brigade there to be a special forces brigade.
Uh-huh.
And then one time they went up to Kurdistan. I was transferred soon after that to be the Special Warfare Plans Officer at U.S. Army Europe Headquarters in Heidelberg.
Now, did you go on the Kurdistan mission, did you say?
No. I didn't go back to Iran.
Oh, okay. Do you know what that, any of those other missions that the team did?
Yeah, they went down to turn the airborne brigade into a Special Forces brigade. And then they went up to Kurdistan, up in the Iranian part of Kurdistan,
mm-hmm.
to see if they could get the Iranian army to get along with the Kurds better, because that was up near the Russian border, and there wasn't much defense up there.
Any idea how that went?
Oh, they tell me that went very well.
Okay.
Uh-huh. The Shah took the only Kurdish general and put him in charge of the division there, and they used the facilities of the division in Tabriz to go after the West and build roads and patrol the area and become friends with the Kurds.
So they made some progress.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit, before we go to your work at U.S. Army headquarters in Europe,
sure.
can you tell me a little bit about what Tehran was like when you were there?
Well,
what do you remember about it?
Not really. We had a nice hotel right across from the American Embassy.
Mm-hmm.
And they had good beer there. And we only stayed in Tehran a couple of days because we came back and turned bodies over and went out the next day.
Okay. How big was the U.S. Embassy at that time?
It was a very large embassy. We didn't have much to do with the embassy.
Okay.
We dealt with the Army Schmag.
And
that was a mission of, they were kind of embarrassed by us. We weren't allowed to wear green berets. We weren't allowed to make our presence known in any way. I tried to get medals for my men, decorations, accommodation medals, these, and they wouldn't hear none of that. They didn't want us down there. The United States had a treaty with the Russians when they got out of Iran, that no organized military groups would be sent to Iran, and they considered us to be an organized military group, and the MAG headquarters there was sort of embarrassed by our presence and by our success. They had tried to get these people out before,
mm-hmm.
and so they were glad to get rid of us, and they didn't have any. We went swimming at the Austria Club once, I remember. But they wanted us out of the country fast, and so they sent a C-130 down for us, and we took off and went to Athens.
Now, that's interesting that they needed you to keep a low profile.
Oh yeah.
So they wouldn't look bad, really.
That's right.
So
they gave us what cooperation they had to, but they didn't want to be bothered with us. We did our job and we got out of there.
Now, you mentioned your next assignment, U.S. Army Europe Headquarters.
Yeah.
And what city was that in? I'm sorry?
Heidelberg.
Okay. And your assignment there began about when?
Oh, gosh. October, November. I was in Pantos about a year, and I was in Heidelberg about a year.
Okay. So late 61 sometime.
Yeah, late 61, was it? Yeah, 62, maybe.
Okay.
I don't remember.
Okay, that's okay. Somewhere in there.
Yeah, well, I spent 2 years in Germany. And then I went back to the Command General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, and I was there in 64 and 65, so it must have been 62 that I went out to Heidelberg.
Okay. Your duties were what? Can you give us
well,
an overview?
Well, first I worked in the War Plans branch until the Special Warfare Planner left. And then I was the Special Warfare Plans Officer, and I developed plans for all of Europe. Special Warfare, I was amazed at how much we knew. These people were going to Poland. I knew exactly where they were going and who they were going to meet there and what their motives were. And so I was in charge of all the specific war plans for Eastern Europe if the war started.
How elaborate, you've given us a little sense of it, but how elaborate were the plans? How detailed?
They were very detailed. I was amazed at how much we knew. Every once in a while, somebody from Eastern Europe would come out, and it was all very hush-hush. The team that was going there never met him, but he'd take some rifle training and weapons training with us, and then we'd get rid of them, and we never knew who these people were. They would be sent to us by Heidelberg, and we'd train them and send them back.
One at a time, or were there sometimes
groups? One at a time.
Okay. So they'd be there, they'd be trained, and then they'd be gone.
Right, and it was all very mysterious.
I'm sure. What kind of complement of personnel worked with you, or were you? Did you have a staff?
When I was in Heidelberg.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was the staff.
You were it.
Yeah.
Okay.
There was one Special Warfare Plans Officer. There was a Contingency Plans Officer. And there were about two or three people in the War Plans branch.
And who did you report to?
There was a colonel, then he left, and there was Colonel Cygnus. He was the director of G3, I guess.
Okay. So he would have been G3 for U.S. Army headquarters?
Europe? Yeah, in okay. Europe. Mm-hmm. Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm. Is there more that you can tell us about this colonel, about the planning, for example?
Well, no. General Cygnus was very good. He got to be lieutenant general, I guess. He was a colonel then.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very fine man from South Carolina, and he knew what was going on.
He was a pretty bright spark.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
can you give us a sense of the what the distribution of resources in the special planning area would have been, for example, as between different countries? Like, was Poland crucial for planning?
Oh, no. We had plans for all the Eastern European countries.
So,
and I was assisted by the CIA agent in charge of Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
He was basically assigned to the Special Warfare Branch. So it was me and him.
Okay.
That was it.
Uh-huh. Where was he from? Do you remember?
I have no idea.
Okay.
He retired in Florida.
Okay. Did you stay in touch with him later in your career? Or?
Later in my career, yeah. He was a very nice man. He had just gotten married to a widow who had a couple of children, and he invited me over to dinner, and he was very nice. We got along with him very well.
Good. Where did you come across him again?
Well, I looked him up when I got back.
Okay.
He was here at CIA headquarters, and then he retired to Florida.
Okay. Is there anything you can tell us about the sort of structure of the plans that you had, or that you?
Well,
were
not
on?
Much. No, they were all top secret.
Okay.
And not anymore, of course. But
right.
I don't remember much about them.
Okay.
I remember once when the first day I took over.
Uh-huh.
And the other colonel, the CIA guy, was explaining the plans to somebody over the phone, and I said, "No, sir, that's not right." And he chewed me out. "I've been with these plans. How do you know you just got here yesterday?" And I said, "Well, I read the plans yesterday because that was my job."
Right.
And I was right, and he was wrong. He hadn't read them in years.
turned out you were up to speed.
Yeah, well, I had to get that way.
That's right. That's right. Were there any points during your time as the plans officer when the U.S. in effect went on alert? I'm thinking about some of the crises of the 1961-62 period.
Well, I guess so. My main function there, we had a, the main function was doing the plans, but we also had, at USER at that time, a subordinate unified command, MEAFSA, Middle East and African South, is sort of what Central Command does now.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to have a maneuver to exercise, because I was on the MEAFSA staff, I had one of the 12 airborne slots at USER year. So I was still a qualified parachutist and getting parachute pay. Mm-hmm. Everybody wanted to get parachute pay, and I'd have to hold them off.
You had to get in line first.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we were going to have a maneuver in Libya. We had an air base in Libya at the time, Wheelis Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to have a maneuver where a battalion of Marines would come ashore, and the airborne brigade from Europe would jump in, and we'd capture this British airfield, and then we'd be evacuated from there. So one of the things I did was go down to Libya on a recon with this, with the airborne people. And we flew into Wheelis, and then we flew to Benghazi, and we flew to Tobruk, and there was a British airfield at Tobruk at El Adem, which was going to be our target. And we explained all this to the British who were down there and to the Libyans.
Mm-hmm.
And we chose a landing zone for the parachutists. They were going to parachute brigade in and then attack the British air base. And we had it all settled, and we were going to do it. And then all of a sudden the State Department said, well, that was too close to Egypt. And they were having some problems with Egypt at the time. They didn't want American brigade on the border. So we didn't do the maneuver. But it was a good chance to visit Libya for me.
but it was called off because of some crisis or apparent difficulty.
Yeah, because the State Department didn't want us to put an airborne brigade that close to the Egyptian-Libyan border.
Hmm. Did things like that happen along the way that were sort of made it seem a little bit futile, or did you think the planning process was still useful?
Oh, the planning process was very good. I was impressed with how much we knew about the people in these Eastern European countries.
Yeah,
I know. That was just that one maneuver. And it was good planning there, too. We know exactly who was coming and where they were going and what they were going to do and how we get them out of there. But the State Department objected to that one.
Now, how close was the cooperation, for example, with the British?
Oh, I'm sure they had a poll ad, a political advisor at USER headquarters. General Freeman was the USER commander at that time, and I'm sure they had a poll ad of his level. I've never met him myself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How cooperative were the British during this?
Oh,
maneuver?
Very good. Uh-huh. We called it a small maneuver, you know, with a battalion of Marines and a brigade of airborne troops, and they thought that was bigger than their whole army. We just called it a small little maneuver, and they were very impressed.
Well, I bet that they were going through a period of reducing.
Oh yeah.
Their military.
Yeah, we met
options.
the British colonel in charge of Cyrenaica, and he was in Benghazi. We landed our plane there, and we had a meeting. He put up. Well, we parked the plane, the C-130, so the little tent that he had set up would be in the shade of the wings. And we were served gin and tonics and all of that.
Of course.
Yeah. And we sat out in the shade of the airplane, which was the only shade around.
That sounds very British, actually.
Oh, yeah. Well, I met a British intelligence officer there, Flight Officer Jarvis. I remember this very well. And he accompanied us all around. He knew every Libyan from the king to the belly dancers, and he told me, he said, well, he was going to give that up and go home next year because his his fiance was getting tired. And I said, oh, how long have you been engaged? And he said, 11 years.
She was getting a bit bored with that, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she was in England and he was in Libya.
Absolutely.
But he'd been engaged for 11 years.
Did you think the U.S. had similarly good intelligence about Libya, for example?
Probably not as good as him. He'd been down there for 11 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he knew everybody.
Mm-hmm. Who was the main liaison that you worked with in Libya? For the U.S., I mean.
Oh, gee, I don't remember.
Was it State Department people, or?
Well, I think they were the military people, because we went into Wheelis Air Force Base, which is an American base in Libya at the
sure.
time.
Uh-huh. So you would have been working mostly with?
With the Libyan military.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the British.
Mm-hmm. Were there other war games or maneuvers in Europe that you recall?
Well, there were some, yeah. We had to go to U.S. Navy, who was in London. We had to coordinate with them. I went to London once.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember somebody came up with the idea that we had no war plan that covered the Paleo-Europe, the NATO concept. And so I had to write a war plan which features the failure of the NATO concept.
And what was the crucial failure that you had to plan around?
Well, that that the Russians overwhelmed them.
Mm-hmm.
And I made some optimistic assessments that we could attack, that we could keep intact the Allied forces and advance or retreat through France to the Pyrenees. And then I had to go to Washington to brief that plan.
How long would it take to study up something like that and actually produce the kind of document in detail that you needed to?
Oh, a couple of weeks write it, and mm-hmm. then you had to get it coordinated all the way up to the top.
And would that then have some ongoing purpose in the contingency planning field?
Well, in the contingency planning field, absolutely.
What would it become, like the paper that they would pull down if something actually happened?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
All the units would be aware of it.
Okay.
And would write their own plans to support it.
Okay, so you would. So.
Excuse me.
That's fine. So, Colonel, if I'm correct, you're drafting a kind of overarching key document that then other units to implement.
Yeah,
had
for the U.S.
to...
Army Europe, and then it would go to all these units mm-hmm. to make their own plans supporting it.
That's incredibly responsible work.
Well, they told me it was they had to have a field grade officer, Leavenworth graduate in that spot, and I was not a Leavenworth graduate, and I was not a field grade officer. I was a captain.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a friend there who pulled me up to help him
okay.
from Vatos. I didn't want to leave Vatos, but he pulled me up to help him, and then so I did.
Were you aware while you were doing it of the strategic significance of the contribution?
Oh, sure. I had to go back to Washington. I was just a captain, and I had to go back to Washington to brief this.
Sure.
And everybody was saying, well, Captain Chandler is just a captain. He can't go to Washington to brief this. And I remember Colonel Signy saying he can brief this at the highest levels.
Now, that was a great vote of confidence from
yeah.
your colonel.
Yeah.
Who did you actually speak to, or where did you go when you were in Washington?
Well, I don't remember. I went to the Pentagon, and I briefed some people, and then I took a little leave and went to my home in North Carolina to see my parents, and then I went back to Germany.
Okay. So, all told, that trip was about how long? Any idea?
Oh, about a week.
Okay. How was the briefing that you gave received?
Well, it went fine, as far as I know.
You don't know what they said after you left the room.
That's right. But they adopted the plan.
Okay. So it was actually integrated then.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned that up to this point you had not been to the general
staff college, right?
Staff college, right. But that was your next move.
That's right.
Okay. Tell me how your orders for that came about.
I got the orders in December. I was supposed to leave Germany in December. And I didn't want to leave in December because I was supposed to go to Fort Leavenworth, and I knew I'd be sitting around for 6 months waiting for the course to begin. So I put in for the final semester program, which means you can take one semester off to do your dissertation. And they approved if you had a PhD going or to finish any kind of a degree that you had. And so I put in for that, and they gave me 6 months to study my dissertation, do my dissertation at Harvard. So I got to Harvard in January, I guess, of 63, and stayed there till June of 63, and then went out to Leavenworth.
Now, in June...
It must have been 64.
Was it 64 then, you
63.
Think?
I got to Harvard in December of about 63.
Uh-huh.
And went to Leavenworth in June of 64.
Okay. Now, sir, you did finish the dissertation, I take it.
I did what?
You did finish the dissertation.
Oh, no, I didn't. Not at that time.
Okay, but later you...
Yeah, I worked on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I finished it later.
Okay. When did you actually finish it, just so I have that as
about,
part of the...
About 74.
Okay. Now...
it was on a different subject completely. We'll get to that.
Okay, tell me what you were working on this time in the early 60s at Harvard.
I was working on the appropriations process and how it came about in the Congress. But all that work was kind of wasted because I had a better subject later on.
Yes, sir.
64, and graduated in 65.
Tell me a little bit about your time at Fort Leavenworth. First of all, where were you living?
I had an apartment in Leavenworth City.
Okay. So you were you weren't living on the base at all?
No.
And you're back to the life of a student, essentially. Is that accurate?
That's right.
Okay.
And I had a Porsche that I'd bought before I left Germany.
Oh, beautiful.
Great.
What year was it?
64, I'm sure.
Fabulous.
Because I took my 30 days leave in Germany before I left, and I went down to Rome to see one of the Italian officers that had been in my counterinsurgency course.
Mm-hmm.
And we went around Rome, and then I guess, I don't know where I went then. I went to Venice, and then I went to Stuttgart to get the 3,000-mile checkup on my Porsche. And then I turned it in to the people who shipped cars and flew home, I guess.
And how many 1964 Porsches were there in Leavenworth, Kansas that year?
No, quite a few.
I can't believe that. Is that really true?
Well, there was there were a couple. There was a guy, a contemporary of mine, Ernie Detweiler, I think, and he and I joined the Kansas City Sports Car Club and went on these rallies every weekend.
That sounds like it was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. We... another friend of mine and I signed up for the Kansas City Ski Club, and we went out to Winter Park, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And the bus, I don't know, had an accident or something broken. We were late getting back, so we had to call Leavenworth, tell him we'd be late on Monday. We wouldn't be back in time for class.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget, it's Colonel Luthi, Luthi. He said that every married man in that class had been him to saying they had to have a day off to greet their wives or to get the furniture that was arriving. He said if two bachelors want to take off and go skiing one day, that's fine with me. Good luck.
Yeah, he sounds like a pretty good commander. Colonel, tell me a little bit about the curriculum at the college. What were you studying?
Well, to some extent we were studying division tactics. And we also studied some political military things. What countries were for us, what countries were against us, and what they could contribute, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, sir.
And I was good at that. They wanted to keep me as an instructor there for the strategic stuff, but I didn't want to stay in Leavenworth. I was out in the middle of nowhere.
It sure is. Still is.
So I got out of being a instructor there.
Mm-hmm. Now, at this point, how large was the situation in Southeast Asia looming?
It was just looming. It wasn't even there. It was
okay.
65. So in June of 65, when we graduated from the Command and General Staff College, that really began my career with Southeast Asia. Because
yes, sir.
I was assigned as to the 1st Brigade of the 5th Division at Fort Devens, Massachusetts. And there were only two battalions in the 5th Division there, the 1st Battalion, 2nd Infantry, and the 2nd Battalion, 2nd Infantry. And when I got there, I found out that they were filling with men.
Mm-hmm.
People that we didn't have were being transferred in. We were being filled up. And then what else happened? We were getting filled. And, oh, yeah, the President and the Secretary of Defense were meeting to find out what to do about Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew exactly what they were going to do because we were getting ready to go. And we were filling, and the Army Times said, "Have you been ordered to dye your underwear green? Then you're going to Vietnam." And we had green underwear hanging from all the windows drying out.
No kidding.
And we were told to take our 5th Division patches on and put 1st Division patches on. So we were part of the 1st Division. The 1st Division apparently had two mechanized battalions who were not going anywhere. And we were going to take their place. So we became members of the 1st Division. And we got maps and everything, but it was still classified.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember my battalion commander, I was a battalion executive officer of the 2nd of the 2nd, Colonel Sheffer, got the whole battalion in the theater. And he said, "I can't tell you where we're going. That's classified. But I'll tell you what we're going to do when we get there. We're going to kill Viet Cong." They all roared and cheered.
So you already knew what was going to happen?
Oh, yeah. We had the maps and everything. We knew where we were going.
You knew exactly where?
We knew
where...
what decision the president was going to make.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to make the decision to send us and the first cap over to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And you were pretty much already in the picture.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Now, the maps that you had, can you tell me, were they general? South
no. They were 1 to 50,000 in the
uh-huh.
specific area we were going to be in, Lai K.
You had the TAC maps of Lai K already?
Oh, yeah. Lai K and Ben Cat
uh-huh.
and the area around them.
Uh-huh.
Michelin Plantation around there.
Yeah.
Three Corps. Yeah, we knew where we were going.
That's amazing. When did you tell your family that you were going to be shipping out?
Well, when everybody else was going to be told, I guess about a week before we left.
Which was...
Because these guys were calling us from all over, from Fort Hood, and should we bring our family, should we come up there prepared to stay, and we told them to leave their families where they would be safe and don't be prepared to stay very long. That's all we could tell them.
Mm-hmm. When did you and the unit actually leave Massachusetts?
Well, the first thing we did was take all of our heavy equipment, like trucks and kitchens and things, down to the port of Boston, and they loaded them up on a ship and sent them off. And then we trained for a couple of weeks without that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then we took our Army training test. And Colonel Shuffer was a very smart man. He flew over to, we packed up some stuff that went by air, and Colonel Shuffer went off on the advance party and left me to command the battalion out to Oakland, California, and we got on a ship there.
And did you meet back up with Colonel, is it Shepherd?
Shuffer.
Okay.
I met back up with him when we got to Vietnam.
Okay, but not before
then. Oh, he didn't take the trip over, heck no. Took us 22 days on that miserable tub.
He was on a plane over there in
a day or so.
So you spent the 22 days with the guys, and you were in command, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. The
okay.
man on the ship.
Okay. And your departure point on the West Coast?
Oakland.
Tell
and
me
we
about...
We landed at Vung Tau. We stopped one day in Okinawa, one night, basically.
Uh-huh. So you landed out at Vung Tau.
Yeah. And they had trucks there to take us up to, where was it? Benoit, to Saigon University. We sort of staged out of there, got together and met up with our equipment.
Mm-hmm. Meaning the South Vietnamese troops, is that right?
No, meaning the trucks and things that we shipped out a month earlier.
Oh, okay.
Or 2 weeks earlier.
Okay, so you met up with the heavy equipment.
Yeah.
And then deployed to?
To Lycay.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a little bit about that, the process of moving over there.
Okay.
You said it was 22 days crossing.
Yeah.
That's a pretty long time. What was the morale of the guys?
Well, it was pretty good because I kept training the whole time. We were a well-trained unit before we got on the ship. I determined we were going to be a well-trained unit when we got off the ship. The Navy had a lieutenant who was in command of the troops. It was a MSCS ship, a civilian ship.
Mm-hmm.
And all it was with transporters over there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had an ongoing fight with the Navy lieutenant. He designated one area. There was a flat area up above the deck, and he designated that as the officer sun deck. And I designated it the 2nd Battalion training area. And I chased all the officers off, and we used it for training. He didn't like that too much. And then they had a barber shop. He had two barbers in there, and the troops were all lined up. And I had three barbers of my own in the battalion. I told him just to give me the barber shop for 2 days, and I'd get everybody to get a haircut. And he wouldn't do that, so I tried to find electrical outlets all over the ship so he could give my troops haircuts. And every place I found, he found some reason why we couldn't do it. The tail was for the civilians who ran the ship. That was their area.
Mm-hmm.
And one place I plucked in, that was the officer's washroom. And so finally, I just quit asking and plucked in any place I could and gave my troops haircuts. And he made the trip miserable.
It sounds like that was kind of unnecessary, fractious relationship.
Well, that's right.
There.
Uh-huh. I had a nice cabin for 9 laid out for myself and the other battalion commander, and he made us live with our with our own officers and gave that to the chaplains. So I had 9 other people in my room, and we all had to lie down if everybody was in there.
Because you couldn't all stand up at the same time?
No, we couldn't. Couldn't all. There wasn't enough room.
Now, tell me about the chaplains that were going over with you.
Well, I don't know much about them. They stayed in there. They were the division chaplains, I guess.
Okay. So these were the Army chaplains that were coming over?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I had one assigned when I got there. He was wonderful. I'll tell you about him later.
Okay, sure. I'll make a note that I should ask you.
Yeah.
Let me also inquire a little bit about Vung Tau. When you actually disembarked...
Yeah, we were the first ones. He wanted to get rid of us.
I bet. He had you in line first to get off.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. when you actually set foot down, what did you see? Do you remember what it looked like?
Not very much. We got immediately into trucks, and we went up to Saigon University. I remember what that looked like.
Tell me about that.
Well, we got there, and all this equipment was coming in, and all American forces. And you looked down the road, and you had a big stack of beer. And you looked a little farther, and you had a big stack of Coca-Cola. And I was thinking, if I was a little VC sitting out in the jungle looking at all this, I'd say, my God, we've lost already. They got more beer and Coca-Cola than we have ammunition. So I was impressed with the great variety and the quantity of ammunition and beer and Coca-Cola we were moving in, and troops. So that was my first impression of Saigon University and Benoit, that we were really moving in with American abundance, and in, the VC were dead.
Uh-huh. In a big way.
Yeah.
Wow. Did you have a sense of threat from VC?
Not really. No, there were so many of us that there's no threat there. They weren't going to do anything. And we were only there for a couple of days to marry up with our equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really funny. My battalion commander went over to the officers' club, and he came back and he said they've got an extra ice-making machine over there if we can use it, but it's only direct current like they have over here, and all of our generators are alternating current. And I said, well, let's take it because I'm sure there's some guy in the battalion that has enough background to change it to direct current. So we took this ice-making machine, and we got to Lycay, and we found that the buildings were like, hey, we were assigned one room in one building to put all of our duffel bags and excess equipment in.
Mm-hmm.
And that place had a plug that was in direct current, so we just plugged the ice machine in and it worked.
And away it went.
So each company, I guess, got a big can of ice every day.
And I'm sure that was very welcome.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir.
We used it.
Yes, sir. On the move up to Lycay from Saigon, you're taking all the equipment with you.
Yeah.
What kind of a road? I think this is Highway 13, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't know what highway it was.
Okay.
It was, might have been Highway 1.
Okay.
Because Highway 1 went... Well, no. That was my second tour. I guess it was Highway 13. We went up to Lycay, and we deployed in Lycay.
And was there an air base there, or what was...
Small airfield, yeah.
Okay, uh-huh. And can you describe the camp as you arrived?
Well, it was a lot of rubber trees. We were in the rubber trees, and there were laterite mud roads in the going along, and those roads were improved by the engineers when we got in there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all spread out. It was among the rubber trees.
You were all spread out?
Yeah, and the companies were along the perimeter. I was in the interior, of course, with the battalion staff.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of facilities did you have?
Oh, tents.
You were in tents?
Yeah.
Okay. Did that change at all during the time you were there?
No, not during the time I was at Lycay.
Okay, and how long were you there?
7 months.
Okay. You were in tents, no prefabs the whole time?
Oh, yeah.
Holy, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I guess later on they put up some free prefabs. But, yeah, this was in September, October of 65.
Mm-hmm. Sir, let's take a break there.
Okay.